Ukrainians who are trying to flee from Ukraine are facing a number of additional challenges, including legal exclusion from certain forms of help and racial discrimination.
Over 2 million refugees, more than half of the 4 million who have fled the conflict so far, have crossed from Ukraine into Poland. According to figures from the Polish border guards, around 4% are not Ukrainian nationals and include significant numbers of African and Asian students.
Reports have emerged that many non-Ukrainians have been subjected to racist and unfair treatment at the border with Poland.
This is unlawful. Everyone has the right to leave Ukraine under these circumstances. Ukrainians, with exception of male Ukrainians who are under military rule, but all foreigners in Ukraine, of course, have to be admitted to the neighboring country, Poland, Hungary or other countries.
Members of the bloc, including Italy, have ratified a 2001 EU directive which grants temporary protection in the event of a mass influx of displaced persons. However, non-Ukrainians have been excluded from the temporary protection scheme.
In this directive, it is foreseen that only those who are directly concerned with a country in crisis are entitled for temporary protection, citizens of that country, and refugees recognized previously in that country, and that other citizens is up to the member states to determine if they would benefit from the temporary protection.
So far, 17 billion euros have been allocated from the EU for Ukrainian refugee reception. However, uncertainty remains around quotas and relocations. Max Civili, Rome.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
این
in the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we said that Imam Khomeini strongly criticized the cinematic art of the previous regime, as it was one of the main sources of immorality in society, particularly among the young generation. He correctly believed that the dramatic arts, mainly cinema, were the tools of colonial policies of the West and anti-Islamic propaganda of the US and its accomplices in the country. This week, we are going to discuss Imam Khomeini's views on political parties and groups, which were, in fact, the puppets of the big powers in Iran. Stay tuned, please. During the years of a struggle against the despotic Pahlavi regime in Iran, different groups resorted to various methods to topple the ruling system. Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization, or MKO, was one of those groups which tried to change the political system via armed struggle. The MKO was formed in 1965 with combination of two contradictory ideologies of Islam and Marxism. This organization managed to take a few terrorist acts against the regime, but in 1971, many of its leaders were identified, tortured, or executed by the intelligence apparatus of the regime, called SAVAK. In 1975, some of the MKO ringleaders, through an organizational coup, officially changed the ideology of the group led to Marxism and committed gruesome murders against their opponents thereafter. Since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, there emerged differences of opinion among the MKO leaders and the revolutionary leaders, to the extent that, following the dismissal of President Abul Hassan Bani Sadr by the parliament, the MKO started armed activities against the Islamic Republic system and martyred a number of officials and thousands of civilians. After the Iraqi invasion of Iran in 1980, the MKO terrorist outfit transferred its base to Iraq and continued its measures against the Iranian nation. Some of the Western countries tried to put the name of the MKO in the blacklist of terrorist groups to stop its crimes against humanity. But through the pressures of influential regimes, especially the United States, they failed to pursue their demands. The terrorist outfit has been employed by Washington, Tel Aviv, and London as a tool to pursue their nefarious goals against the Iranian nation and the Islamic Republic system. The founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, writes in his testament, "My advice and recommendation to the groups, grouplets, and persons who are active against the nation, the Islamic Republic and Islam, first, in addressing their ringleaders inside and outside the country, is that the long experience of taking any measure, designing any plot, and resorting to any country and official should have taught to you, who consider yourselves as knowledgeable and wise, that the course of a selfless nation cannot be misled by resorting to terror, blast, bomb, and baseless and uncalculated lies. Never can any state and government be toppled through inhumane and illogical methods, especially a nation like Iran, whose young children to its old women and men are sacrificing their lives in the way of the goal, the Islamic Republic, the Quran, and religion. You know, and if you do not, you are thinking very naively that the nation is not with you and the army is not with you. And if you suppose that they have been with you as your friends, your bungling acts and crimes that have occurred through your provocation have separated them from you, and you have failed to do anything except forging enemies, unquote. Imam Khomeini, addressing terrorist groups, especially the MKO, writes in another part of his testament, "In the end of my life, I benevolently recommend you who have started fighting and countering this afflicted nation, which has saved itself from the oppression of criminals like the Pahlavi regime and the world devourers of the East and the West through sacrificing their best children and youth. How can the conscience of a human, no matter how wicked it is, to be content for the likely achieving of a position to behave his country and his nation in this way and does not have mercy towards their young and the elderly?" The Imam advises the ringleaders of these grouplets not to be deceived by big powers. He writes, "I advise you to give up such useless and unwise acts and not be gulled by the world devourers. And wherever you are, if you have committed crime, return to your country and the lap of Islam. Repent, as God is the most merciful of the merciful, and the Islamic Republic and the nation will, inshallah, forgive you. And if you have committed a crime that God has determined your decree, still return from halfway and return. Or if you are not brave enough, accept the punishment, and hence, save yourselves from God's painful punishment. Otherwise, wherever you are, do not waste your life anymore and embark on another job as it is to your benefit." Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, addressing the internal and external advocates of the MKO terrorist grouplet, writes in his testament, "Then I recommend their internal and external advocates, for what motive do you waste your youth for those whom have been proved to be serving the powerful world devourers and follow their schemes and have been fallen in their traps? In whose way are you wronging your own nation? You are the big gully of them, and if you are in Iran, you're witnessing that the million-strong masses are loyal to the Islamic Republic and sacrifice for it. And you are witnessing that the current state and regime are wholeheartedly at the service of the destitute. And those who are spuriously feigning popularity, being mujahid and devotees of the people, have embarked on enmity against God's people and have beguiled you simple boys and girls for their purposes and the purposes of one of the world-devouring Poles' of power. Whereas they are either reveling in the lap of one of the criminal posts or inside the country, they are leading a luxurious life in team houses like the houses of the wretched criminals while sending you youths to death. My kind advice to you teenagers and youths inside and outside is to return from the wrong way and be united with the deprived of the society who are serving the Islamic Republic wholeheartedly. And be active for the independent and free Iran, to that the country and the nation get rid of the evil of the opponents and all continue noble life together. How long and why will you be subordinate to those who do not think except for their vested interest? You are fighting your nation in the lap of the superpowers while they have sacrificed you for their sinister purposes and seeking power.
This one lay. Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It is something Iran has accused the U.S. of before, yet the U.S. has failed in that regard, failing in making political decisions, which Iran has said has led to a halt in the Vienna talks. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the Iranian accusations against the U.S., one in which Iran has said that the U.S. is trying to hold the remaining issues hostage to its internal affairs. What those internal affairs are and the chances of the JCPOA revival talks' success are other issues we will look at in this edition of The Spotlight. To get the latest, first we're going to cross on over to Vienna and talk to our correspondent, Homolesky. Homolesky, at this point we know that Iran is very critical of the U.S., not that it has not been before, but at this stage it is pretty important. Tell us why.
Yeah, so let's look at the comments that have been made by Iranian top Iranian officials, the foreign minister himself, the foreign ministry spokesman, saying that when very recently Enrique Mora, the EU coordinator, came to Iran, the Iranians gave him the message or the response or the proposals on how to resolve the remaining issues. The red lines were clear. How far Iran was willing to go was clear. Now it's the U.S. that has to respond, and it has not done so. Here in Vienna, there were reports, of course, that the media tent outside the Coburg Palais Hotel is being dismantled. And in response to media reports about speculations as to what this means for the fate of the negotiations, the Russian ambassador, Mikhail Olyanov, tweeted, saying that because everything basically has already been written, the texts are already, and there are just these remaining issues between the Iranians and the Americans, once and if these issues are resolved, there'll only be a requirement for the participants to have a very short, in his words, meeting to announce formally the decision that they want to revive the JCPOA. But what Iran is asking now is the U.S. really willing to do that? Does it want the JCPOA to be revived? Because if it does, it has to adopt a realistic approach. It has to announce the political decision. What are the remaining issues? From various reports we're hearing, it includes the scope of sanctions, the extent of sanctions that need to be rolled back, including those affecting Iran's IRGC, as well as guarantees that any future U.S. president would not withdraw from the JCPOA. So what we're seeing now in terms of how analysts, commentators are viewing the situation, they're saying this is the Biden administration that came into the White House with the campaign promise to undo what the Trump administration did when it came to the JCPOA. Ms. Biden was vehemently against the move by President Trump to withdraw from the JCPOA, but now they say he's effectively exploiting that decision and increasing pressure on Iran, especially since the U.S. also very recently introduced new sanctions on individuals and companies in Iran. Is there a will on the American side, Iran is asking, to make this happen? Because if they do resolve these very few issues that all participants believe can be resolved, then it is still realistic to assume that the JCPOA can come back to life.
Thank you very much for that. Homa Lesky there from Vienna. We do appreciate it. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have political analyst Saeed Mostafa Khoshesh, who joins us from Tehran. Also joining us, writer and political analyst John White, who joins us from Edinburgh.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, Saeed Mostafa Khoshesh. Iran has made some statements, and let's look at one of them, if you can break it down for us as to what it means. Khatibzadeh, the Iranian foreign ministry spokesperson, saying all of us should not forget that what we are facing today is not an administration that wants to perform its duties, but rather one that seeks to exploit legal means in order not to honor its obligations. What is he saying there?
Well, thanks for having me. If you just take a look at what the Biden administration has been doing, it's just a continuation of the maximum pressure policy that came into effect under Donald Trump. Before even Biden came to office, Bolton, the former national security advisor, as well as many other Trump administration officials, acknowledged that the maximum pressure policy has failed. Also, the Biden administration, Blinken, Jake Sullivan, Biden himself, they have all acknowledged that this policy has failed to produce any kind of result for the United States verbally. But when it comes into action, they still continue the same kind of policy. They continue the carrot and stick. They still continue imposing sanctions on Iran. And they're not at all apparently worried about the negotiations, since we are at the final stage of the talks. And they still continue imposing further sanctions on Iran and Iranians. So what they are doing basically is continuing Donald Trump's strategy. They are not really very much willing for honoring their duties and undertakings under the JCPOA. Otherwise, it wouldn't have required us to go into negotiations. They could have easily done that as soon as Biden came to office. He could have, resumed compliance with the terms of the JCPOA last year, even without the talks, because we are talking about very specific and clear and transparent undertakings of the United States and Iran under the JCPOA. Mm-hmm. But the Americans are not willing to, relinquish their weapon of choice. That's the sanctions. That's why the talks have been stalled.
John White, we are looking at a date here of March 27th. That's when Enrique Mora, after visiting Tehran, departed. with messages. He had met with high-ranking Iranian officials, including the Iranian foreign minister. And he left with messages from Tehran to Washington. Yeah. And according to what Iran is saying that we're still waiting for the answers from the other side. Mind you, that Iran did obviously make sure to, again, make it clear that the lack of the ability for the U.S. to make a political decision to remove the sanctions that are tied to economic benefits of the Iranian people is the only existing obstacle. At that point is what the Iranian foreign minister said to Enrique Mora. If that's the case, why is the U.S. not answering?
Well, thanks for having me. It's quite extraordinary that we've reached this point with regards to these negotiations in Vienna. On an objective, moral, ethical level, the U.S. should have long before now lifted the sanctions of Iran and agreed to resuscitate the JCPOA on the same terms as it was agreed initially in 2015. And Iran's foreign minister is absolutely correct when he says that Joe Biden is being held hostage by his own internal politics. His approval ratings have gone through the floor, now down to 39%. He's perceived by more and more Americans from their point of view as a weak leader. The Afghanistan debacle from their point of view in August last year, he's tried to play a strong card against Russia vis-a-vis the Ukraine conflict. That's only exacerbated the suffering of the American working class in terms of rising fuel prices and food prices. So it's quite inexplicable, if you understand this on a certain level, that the Biden administration will not acquiesce to Iran's reasonable demands. But you know what? Joe Biden has his biggest enemy is not Russia, it's not Iran, it's Donald Trump. And Trump is breathing down his shoulder. And this is where we are now with American politics. Joe Biden and the Democrats understand that Trump is likely to be re-elected in 2024 unless he plays tough with Iran vis-a-vis how Donald Trump did. And this is where the problem lies. The Iranians have nothing to apologize for. Joe Biden and his administration are being led down this path to perdition by Donald Trump and the pressure raid against him from the Republicans in the U.S. itself. It's a very sad state of affairs, but this is reality of a declining hegemonic power.
Well, I was going to ask this later, but let's get down to it, Sayyid Mostafa Khoshchesh, regarding what John White is saying there. First of all, it's one of the guarantees that Iran does want is if a new administration does come, it needs to have some kind of guarantee that it's not going to rip up the agreement. But tell us about the deal with Congress. What is that all about? Looking at one particular source, Sayyid Mostafa Khoshchesh, it says the president, Biden, will get his way because it's unlikely that Congress is going to be able to block a new agreement. And it refers back, based on this source and many other sources, actually, to when Obama actually went through and finally got its approval for the JCPOA at that point. So where does that stand?
You know, it's true that part of the problem comes from the very fact that the Biden administration is stuck with internal political disputes and rivalries and the problems that he might have domestically and especially at the Congress. But a part of the fact is this point, that this is a U.S. strategy towards Iran. It's not just the Biden administration. It's not the Donald Trump administration policy. It's the U.S. policy that came into effect under Obama, even 9 months before Obama came to office. This is the containment strategy. They do not want a conflict resolution with Iran. Let's remember that Iran and the U.S. or its European allies, they have had six cases of agreements in the past two decades. One over Afghanistan, the other one in 2003 over Iraq, three others with European states from 2003 to 2005, and the last one being the JCPOA in 2015. In all of them, according to U.S. officials and experts, Iran has been in full compliance with its undertakings because Iran has always believed in a conflict resolution approach, and it has believed, rightly or wrongly, that the deal is for conflict resolution. But the United States and its allies, they have never been in compliance with the terms of all these deals, mainly removal of sanctions, because they have never meant to go for a conflict resolution approach. What they've been doing is going for a deal in line or in the framework of containment strategy. Mm-hmm. What does it mean? It means if we have a nuclear deal and everyone sticks to the deal, then they need to contain Iran's power components with regard to its missile industry, regional power, and its laser industry, nanotechnology, aerospace program, and so on and so forth. Because what they want to do is containing Iran's power. So the best weapon of choice that they got in here is the sanctions. So they always remain adamant to removing the sanctions. And now, right now, what is the problem with the talks that we don't see a deal? It's removal of sanctions on certain Iranian entities, legal and real persons. That includes actually Iranian individuals, firms, and entities that have been placed in the red list. And the U.S., which agreed a few months ago to remove them from the red list, has shown buyer's remorse. That's a known or notorious U.S. negotiating tactic. They have been doing this buyer's remorse all the time whenever they come to a deal with Iran and to the talks with Iran. Here, we are through with 97% of issues. But these three percent left, this is very important, because if they remove this part of the sanctions from the red list of entities, firms, and individuals, then Iran would have a great more of economic merits from such a deal, and they do not want it to happen because they want to keep the sanctions structure intact. They might suspend some sanctions, but they do not want Iran to enjoy the full merits of any possible deal. That's why they are adamant to doing what is right.
Right. Well, let's talk about these sanctions that obviously they never come at a good time, but this is really at a very sensitive time, John White. And what message am I going to ask you this sends? And particularly when we take a look also at the other angle of these sanctions, where it was basically on individuals and companies that are linked to Iran's ballistic missile program for providing assistance to Iran's ballistic missile program. I mean, they're targeting the defense of a country. You know, that's something that is Iran's red lines. So why would they go through with these sanctions?
Well, these are non-nuclear issues. These are incompatible with the original terms of the JCPOA that did not cover non-nuclear issues regarding, for example, as you just mentioned, Iran's ballistic missile program. Iran has a legitimate security interest, and they have a duty bound to their own people to uphold these security interests. This is trying to neuter Iran as a strong power in the region, and it's also a backhanded compliment, if I may say, to Iran's growing influence in the region as a pillar of stability in a region that's been mired in instability since the invasion of Iraq in 2003. But let's not be under any illusions. This is not just about US foreign policy. This is about Saudi and Israeli foreign policy. And they are having a major influence on the Biden administration's stance vis-a-vis these negotiations in Vienna. And it's a very sad state of affairs when you have a US president unsteady on his feet, cognitively challenged, who's struggling to maintain his own foreign policy. It is quite significant that his calls to the UAE and Saudi Arabia recently in the context of the Ukraine conflict to try and get them to produce more oil to stabilize energy prices globally were refused. That is quite unprecedented when you think about Washington's relationship and its influence in the Middle East. It is a waning power, and Joe Biden is a symptom of that waning power. So my suggestion to Iran, if I can say, is to stay firm, stand strong, and see this out, because the US is not the future. And I think the Iranian government and its institutions understand that. And that's why they're insisting that they will not budge from their demand that before anything can be agreed in Vienna, all sanctions must be lifted in accordance with the 2015 agreement.
Okay, let's get to one of the core issues that seems to be at hand here, Sayyid Mostafa Khoshchesh, and tell us if it is, because there are many that Iran has pointed out to. But when it comes to the IRGC, we're looking at obviously a red line and a key sticking point, and it doesn't make sense
how this is a sticking point where it's a red line. And I'm going to put this into context and then ask you, how could this even be resolved in terms of it being on the terrorist list organization, as the U.S. has done, when the U.S. Special Envoy, Robert Malley, has said that sanctions on the IRGC would remain in place even if an agreement to restore the deal is reached?
Okay. First of all, this is not the main point that has been left. This is it is one of the very few points that have been left. The most important issue, as I just said, is removing sanctions on specific legal and real persons that includes firms, individuals, and entities in the SDN list or the so-called red list that's a part of the SDN list, that they remain adamant to removing the sanctions on these individuals and entities, because removing sanctions from these entities, individuals, and firms would enhance economic merits for Iran under any possible view. And this is very important, because I'll explain about it. Removing, IRGC from the list, the IRGC has been tagged multiple times. If I'm not mistaken, under four tags, it's been sanctioned. One of them is the SDGT. If they remove this tag, there will be economic merits for Iran. But when it comes to FTO, or foreign terrorist organization, because of supporting resistant movements in the region, this is just a political tag. It doesn't include economic merits. It's just a political sanction. It is the worst. It's the worst type of, tag or sanction on, any country an organization or an official military of a country. And by the way, the IRGC is the official military, the army of Iran, and no other military in the world has been sanctioned by the U.S. or any other country. This is something very illegal, like other U.S. sanctions on Iran and other countries and companies throughout the world. But this FTO, as I just said, is just a political tag. If they remove it, it means a very great defeat for the United States that tagged the IRGC on their FTO a couple of years ago. Actually, not a couple, but in 2018, they placed it under the FTO in the FTO list. But its removal would not entail any economic merits for Iran. That's why I and some other experts insist that Iran should also continue its insistence on removing the SDGT tag as well. This is one of the other key issues. I'm not hearing about it very often in the media, but this is one more point that needs to go under discussions. And in a few more months, as the global developments are, especially with regard to the Russian confrontation with the West over Ukraine, as things are developing, especially in the energy market, soon we will see that if there is to be a deal, definitely the United States would be required to do more and to give more points and to give more merits, including removing of the SDGT from the IRGC.
John White, this administration is very keen, and Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi, while running for presidency, said that we are going to enhance our relations with our neighbors, and it's doing so, and we can see the results. One of them being the major one, I'm guessing here, which is still in the works somewhat, is its relation with Saudi Arabia. Of course, we have that major development come where the Iranian Foreign Minister, Amir Abdullahian, spoke to the UN Secretary General Guterres and spoke about the JCPOA revival talks, and also the fact that there was a ceasefire between Yemen, the official government of Yemen, and Saudi Arabia, a ceasefire for 2 months at this point. Do you think then that this is something that may lead to, I guess I'm just going to say, the U.S. realizing that Iran is taking the right steps in order to regionally calm things down, because it's doing all it can diplomatically with its neighbors, or not?
Well, in the West, in the context of the conflict in Ukraine, ideology has superseded pragmatism, and that's always a bad position to be. That is the road to perdition. And I think Iran is an absolute arbiter of pragmatism over ideology. Iran is willing to forge bilateral productive relations with all its neighbours, including Saudi Arabia, despite all the enmity that has existed between those two countries for many, many years. And I think that pragmatism will always trump, no pun intended, ideology in the last analysis. I think the US has to understand, if it tries to cancel Russia and its energy supplies, it has to allow Iran's oil to be a part of the world energy market in order to stabilize global prices. Because ultimately, when people go to fill their cars up in California or New York or any part of the US, that will determine the political trajectory of that country. And the Biden administration must understand that it must acquiesce to the reality of the condition of the American people in terms of its economy. And that is a problem that Biden has.
Right.
He's been pushed by ideologues in his own administration in Washington to take these very radical steps, and it's going to be his undoing.
Thank you so much. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. But thank you for that, John White, writer and political analyst. Said Mostafa Khoshesh, also thank you for your input. Political analyst spoke to us from Tehran. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vitakwe and the entire team, it's goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Hundreds of Palestinians were killed in Tantura in cold blood. They were buried in mass graves, the largest of which is believed to be under a parking lot. The Tantura massacre and its aftermath is arguably the most glaring representation of the Zionist regime's criminality. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Ramzi Barood, journalist and editor-in-chief of Palestine Chronicle. This article is titled, From Tantura to Naqab, Zionist regime's long hidden truths are finally revealed. Stay tuned for more.
A succession of events in recent weeks all point to the inescapable fact that nearly 75 years of the Zionist regime's painstaking efforts aimed at hiding the truth about its origins and its current racially driven apartheid regime are failing miserably. The world is finally waking up. And the Zionist regime is losing ground quicker than its ability to gain new supporters or to whitewash its past or ongoing crimes. First, there was Tantura, a peaceful Palestinian village whose inhabitants were mostly exterminated by the Zionist regime's Alexandroi Brigade on May 23, 1948. Like many other massacres committed against unarmed Palestinians throughout the years, the massacre of Tantura was mostly remembered by the village's survivors, by ordinary Palestinians and by Palestinian historians. The mere attempt in 1998 by an Israeli graduate student, Theodor Katz, to shed light on that bloody event ignited a legal, media and academic war, forcing him to retract his findings. In a recent social media post, Israeli professor Ilan Pape revealed why, in 2007, he had to resign his position at Haifa University. Pape wrote, "One of my crimes was insisting that there was a massacre in the village of Tantura in 1948, as was exposed by MA student Teddy Katz. Now, some Alexandro Brigade veterans have finally decided to confess to the crimes in Tantura. They silenced it. It mustn't be told. It could cause a whole scandal. I don't want to talk about it, but it happened." These were the words of Moshe Diamant, a former member of Alexandre Brigade, who, with other veterans, revealed in the documentary Tantura by Alan Schwartz the gory details and the horrific crimes that transpired in the Palestinian village. An officer killed one Arab after the other with his pistol, Micha Victon, a former soldier, said. Another explained, "They put them into a barrel and shot them in the barrel. I remember the blood in the barrel. I was a murderer. I didn't take prisoners," Amitzur Cohen admitted. Hundreds of Palestinians were killed in Tantura in cold blood. They were buried in mass graves, the largest of which is believed to be under a parking lot at Dor Beach, flocked by Israeli families daily. The Tantura massacre and its aftermath is arguably the most glaring representation of Israeli criminality. However, this is not the story of Tantura alone. The latter is a representation of something much bigger, of mass-scale ethnic cleansing, forcible evictions and mass killing. Thankfully, much truth is being unearthed. In 1951, the Zionist regime's army launched a full-scale military operation that ethnically cleansed Palestinian Bedouins from the Naqab. The tragic sins of entire communities being uprooted from their ancestral homes were justified by the Zionist regime with the usual cliché that the terrible deed was carried out for security reasons. In 1953, the Zionist regime passed the so-called land acquisition law, which allowed the Israeli regime to seize the land of the Palestinians who were forced out of their homes. By then, the Zionist regime had unlawfully expropriated 247,000 dunams in the Naqab, with 66,000 remaining unutilized. The remaining land is currently the epicenter of an ongoing saga involving Palestinian Bedouin communities in the occupied territories and the Zionist regime, which falsely claims that the land is essential for the Zionist regime's development needs. We'll be right back. recently revealed documents uncovered by extensive research conducted by Professor Gadi Al-Ghazi points towards the Zionist regime's version of the truth in Naqab being a complete fabrication. According to numerous uncovered documents, Moshe Dayan, then head of the Zionist regime's Army Southern Command, was central to an Israeli regime and military ploy to evict Bedouin population and to revoke their rights as landowners, per the conveniently created Israeli law, which allowed the regime to lease the land of it if its own. There was an organized transfer of Bedouin citizens from the northwestern Negev eastward to barren areas with the goal of taking over the lands. They carried out this operation using a mix of threats, violence, bribery and fraud, Al-Ghazi told the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. In an interview with Agence France-Presse, Lemire stated that his book offers definitive written proof on the premeditation, planning and coordination of this operation, and that includes official meetings between Kolek, the commander of the Zionist regime's army, and another top regime officials. The story continues. More heartbreaking revelations and a well-integrated version of the truth are exposing long-hidden or denied facts. The days of Israel getting away with these crimes seem to be behind us. An example is Amnesty International's recent report, Israel's Apartheid Against Palestinians, a look into decades of oppression and domination. Amnesty's 280 pages of damning evidence of the Zionist regime's racism and apartheid did not shy away from connecting the Zionist regime's violent present with its equally bloody past. It did not borrow from the Zionist regime's deceptive language and self-serving division of Palestinians into disconnected communities, each with a different claim and a different status. For Amnesty, as was the case with Human Rights Watch report in April 2021, the Zionist injustices against the Palestinians must be recognized and duly condemned in their entirety. Since its establishment in 1948, Israel has pursued an explicit policy of establishing and maintaining a Jewish demographic hegemony, while minimizing the number of Palestinians and restricting their rights, the reporter stated. This could only happen through mass killing, ethnic cleansing, and genocide from Tantura to the Naqab, to the Moroccan quarters, to Gaza and Sheikh Jarrah.